The Return of the King, Disc 12.
They rode back to the middle of the village. There Sam turned aside and galloped off down the lane that led south to Cotton's. He had not gone far when he heard a sudden clear horn call go up ringing into the sky. Far over hill and field it echoed, and so compelling was that call that Sam himself almost turned and dashed back. His pony reared and neighed. "On, lad, on!" he cried. "We'll be going back soon." Then he heard Merry change the note, and up went the horn cry of Buckland, shaking the air. "Awake! Awake! Fear, fire, foes! Awake! Fire, foes! Awake!" Behind him, Sam heard a hubbub of voices and a great din and slamming of doors. In front of him, lights sprang out in the gloaming. Dogs barked. Feet came running. Before he got to the lane's end, there was Farmer Cotton with three of his lads. Young Tom, Jolly, and Nick, hurrying towards him. They had axes in their hands and barred the way. "Nay, it's not one of them ruffians," Sam heard the farmer say. "It's a hobbit by the size of it, but all dressed up queer. Hey," he cried. "Who are you, and what's all this to do?"
"It's Sam, Sam Gamgee. I've come back."
Farmer Cotton came up close and stared at him in the twilight.
"Well," he exclaimed, "the voice is right, and your face is no worse than it was, Sam. But I should have passed you in the street in that gear. You've been in foreign parts, seemingly. We feared you were dead."
"That I ain't," said Sam, "nor Mr. Frodo. He's here and his friends, and that's the to-do. They're raising the shire. We're going to clear out these ruffians and their chief, too. We're starting now."
"Good, good!" cried Farmer Cotton. "So it's begun at last. I've been itching for trouble all this year, but folks wouldn't help, and I've had the wife and Rosie to think of. These ruffians don't stick at nothing. But come on now, lads, Bywater is up. We must be in it."
"What about Mrs. Cotton and Rosie?" said Sam. "It isn't safe yet for them to be left all alone."
"My Nibs is with them, but you can go and help him if you have a mind," said Farmer Cotton with a grin. Then he and his sons ran off towards the village.
Sam hurried to the house. By the large round door at the top of the steps from the wide yard stood Mrs. Cotton and Rosie, and Nibs in front of them, grasping a hayfork.
"It's me!" shouted Sam as he trotted up. "Sam Gamgee! So don't try prodding me, Nibs. Anyway, I've a mail shirt on me."
He jumped down from his pony and went up the steps. They stared at him in silence.
"Good evening, Mrs. Cotton," he said. "Hello, Rosie."
"Hello, Sam," said Rosie. "Where have you been? They said you were dead, but I've been expecting you since the spring. You haven't hurried, have you?"
"Perhaps not," said Sam abashed. "But I'm hurrying now. We're sitting about the ruffians, and I've got to get back to Mr. Frodo. But I thought I'd have a look and see how Mrs. Cotton was keeping, and you, Rosie."
"We're keeping nicely, thank you," said Mrs. Cotton, "or should be, if it weren't for those thieving ruffians."
"Well, be off with you," said Rosie. "If you've been looking after Mr. Frodo all this while, what do you want to leave him for, as soon as things look dangerous?" This was too much for Sam. It needed a week's answer or none. He turned away and mounted his pony. But as he started off, Rosie ran down the steps.
"I think you look fine, Sam," she said. "Go on now, but take care of yourself, and come straight back as soon as you've settled the ruffians."
When Sam got back, he found the whole village roused. Already, apart from many younger lads, more than 100 sturdy hobbits were assembled with axes and heavy hammers and long knives and stout staves, and a few had hunting bows. More were still coming in from outlying farms. Some of the village folk had lit a large fire, just to enliven things, and also because it was one of the things forbidden by the chief. It burned bright as night came on. Others, at Merry's orders, were setting up barriers across the road at each end of the village. When the sheriffs came up to the lower one, they were dumbfounded. But as soon as they saw how things were, most of them took off their feathers and joined in the revolt. The others slunk away. Sam found Frodo and his friends by the fire, talking to old Tom Cotton, while an admiring crowd of Bywater folk stood round and stared.
"Well, what's the next move?" said Farmer Cotton.
"I can't say," said Frodo, "until I know more. How many of these ruffians are there?"
"That's hard to tell," said Cotton. "They moves about and comes and goes. There's sometimes 50 of them in their sheds up Hobbiton way, but they go out from there roving round, thieving or gathering, as they call it. Still, they're seldom less than a score round the boss, as they names him. He's at Bag End, or was, but he don't go outside the grounds now. No one's seen him at all, in fact, for a week or two, but the men don't let no one go near."
"Hobbiton's not their only place, is it?" said Pippin.
"No, more's the pity," said Cotton. "There's a good few down south in Longbottom and by Sarn Ford, I hear, and some more lurking in the woody end, and they've sheds at Weymeat. And then there's the lockholes, as they call 'em, the old storage tunnels at Mickle Delving that they've made into prisons for those as stand up to them. Still, I reckon there's not above 300 of them in the shire all told, and maybe less. We can master them if we stick together."
"Have they got any weapons?" asked Merry.
"Whips, knives and clubs, enough for their dirty work. That's all they've showed so far," said Cotton. "But I dare say they've got other gear if it comes to fighting. Some have bows, anyway. They've shot one or two of our folk."
"There you are, Frodo," said Merry. "I knew we should have to fight."
"Well, they started the killing."
"Not exactly," said Cotton. "Leastways, not the shooting. Tooke started that. You see, your dad, Mr. Peregrine, he's never had no truck with this Lotho, not from the beginning. Said that if anyone was going to play the chief at this time of day, it would be the right thane of the shire and no upstart. And when Lotho sent his men, they got no change out of him. Tooks are lucky. They've got those deep holes in the green hills, the great smiles and all, and the ruffians can't come at 'em.
And they won't let the ruffians come on their land. If they do, Tooks hunt 'em. Tooks shot 3 for prowling and robbing. After that the ruffians turn nastier, and they keep a pretty close watch on Tooke land. No one gets in nor out of it now."
"Good for the Tooks," cried Pippin. "But someone's going to get it again now. I'm off to the Smiles. Anyone coming with me to Tuckborough?" Pippin rode off with a half a dozen lads on ponies. "See you soon," he cried. "It's only 14 miles or so over the fields. I'll bring you back an army of Tooks in the morning." Merry blew a horn call after them as they rode off into the gathering night. The people cheered. "All the same," said Frodo to all those who stood near, "I wish for no killing, not even of the ruffians, unless it must be done, to prevent them from hurting hobbits."
"All right," said Merry. "But we shall be having a visit from the Hobbiton gang any time now, I think. They won't come just to talk things over. We'll try to deal with them neatly, but we must be prepared for the worst. Now, I've got a plan."
"Very good," said Frodo. "You make the arrangements."
Just then some hobbits, who had been sent out towards Hobbiton, came running in.
"They're coming," they said, "a score or more, but 2 have gone off west across country."
"To Weymeat, that'll be," said Cotton, "to fetch more of the gang."
"Well, it's 15 mile each way. We needn't trouble about them just yet."
Merry hurried off to give orders. Farmer Cotton cleared the street, sending everyone indoors, except the older hobbits who had weapons of some sort. They had not long to wait. Soon they could hear loud voices, and then the tramping of heavy feet. Presently a whole squad of the ruffians came down the road. They saw the barrier and laughed.
They didn't imagine that there was anything in this little land that would stand up to 20 of their kind together. The hobbits opened the barrier and stood aside.
"Thank you," the men jeered. "Now run home to bed before you're whipped." Then they marched along the street shouting, "Put those lights out! Get indoors and stay there, or we'll take 50 of you to the lockholes for a year. Get in. The boss is losing his temper."
No one paid any heed to their orders. but as the ruffians passed, they closed in quietly behind and followed them. When the men reached the fire, there was Farmer Cotton standing all alone, warming his hands.
"Who are you, and what do you think you're doing?" said the ruffian leader.
Farmer Cotton looked at him slowly.
"I was just going to ask you that," he said. "This isn't your country, and you're not wanted."
"Well, you're wanted anyhow," said the leader. "We want you. Take him, lads. Lock holes for him, and give him something to keep him quiet."
The men took one step forward and stopped short. There rose a roar of voices all round them, and suddenly they were aware that Farmer Cotton was not all alone. They were surrounded. In the dark, on the edge of the firelight, stood a ring of hobbits that had crept up out of the shadows. There was nearly 200 of them, all holding some weapon. Merry stepped forward.
"We've met before," he said to the leader, "and I warned you not to come back here.
I warn you again. You're standing in the light and you're covered by archers. If you lay a finger on this farmer, or on anyone else, you'll be shot at once. Lay down any weapons that you have." The leader looked round. He was trapped. But he was not scared, not now with the score of his fellows to back him. He knew too little of hobbits to understand his peril. Foolishly he decided to fight. It would be easy to break out.
"Adam, lads," he cried. "Let 'em have it."
With a long knife in his left hand and a club in the other, he made a rush at the ring, trying to burst out back towards Hobbiton. He aimed a savage blow at Merry, who stood in his way. He fell dead with four arrows in him. That was enough for the others. They gave in. Their weapons were taken from them, and they were roped together, and marched off to an empty hut that they had built themselves, and there they were tied hand and foot, and locked up under guard. The dead leader was dragged off and buried.
"Seems almost too easy after all, don't it?" said Cotton. "I said we could master them, but we needed a call. You came back in the nick of time, Mr. Merry."
"There's more to be done still," said Merry. "If you're right in your reckoning, we haven't dealt with a tithe of them yet. But it's dark now.
I think the next stroke must wait until morning. Then we must call on the chief."
"Why not now?" said Sam. "It's not much more than 6 o'clock, and I want to see my gaffer. Do you know what's come of him, Mr. Cotton?"
"He's not too well, and he's not too bad, Sam," said the farmer. "They dug up Bagshot Row, and that was a sad blow to him. He's in one of them new houses that the chief's men used to build while they still did any work other than burning and thieving, not above a mile from the end of Bywater. But he comes round to me when he gets a chance, and I see he's better fed than some of the poor bodies, all against the rules, of course. I'd have had him with me, but that wasn't allowed."
"Thank ye indeed, Mr. Cotton, and I'll never forget it," said Sam.
"But I want to see him. That boss and that Sharky, as they spoke of, they might do a mischief up there before the morning." "All right, Sam," said Cotton. "Choose a lad or two, and go and fetch him to my house. You'll not have need to go near the old Hobbiton village over water. My jolly here will show you."
Sam went off. Merry arranged for lookouts round the village and guards at the barriers during the night. Then he and Frodo went off with Farmer Cotton. They sat with the family in the warm kitchen, and the Cottons asked a few polite questions about their travels, but hardly listened to the answers. They were far more concerned with events in the Shire.
"It all began with Pimple, as we call him," said Farmer Cotton. "And it began as soon as you'd gone off, Mr. Frodo. He'd funny ideas, had Pimple. Seems he wanted to own everything himself, and then order other folk about. It soon came out that he already did own a sight more than was good for him, and he was always grabbing more, though where he got the money was a mystery. Mills and malthouses and inns and farms and leaf plantations. He'd already bought Sandyman's Mill before he came to Bag End, seemingly. Of course he started with a lot of property in the South Farthing, which he had from his dad. And it seems he'd been selling a lot of the best leaf and sending it away quietly for a year or two. But at the end of last year, he began sending away loads of stuff, not only leaf. Things began to get short, and winter coming on too. Folk got angry, but he had his answer. A lot of men, ruffians mostly, came with great wagons, some to carry off the goods south away, and others to stay. And more came. And before we knew where we were, they were planted here and there all over the shire, and were felling trees and digging and building themselves sheds and houses just as they liked. At first goods and damage were paid for by Pimple, but soon they began lording it around and taking what they wanted. Then there was a bit of trouble, but not enough. Old Will the Mayor set off for Baggin to protest, but he never got there. Ruffians laid hands on him, and took and locked him up in a hole in Mickledelving, and there he is now. And after that, it would be soon after New Year, there wasn't no more mayor, and Pimple called himself Chief Sheriff, or just Chief, and did as he liked. And if anyone got uppish, as they called it, they followed Will. So things went from bad to worse. There wasn't no smoke left, save for the men, and the chief didn't hold with beer, save for his men, and closed all the inns. And everything except rules got shorter and shorter, unless one could hide a bit of one's own when the ruffians went round gathering stuff up for fair distribution. Which meant they got it and we didn't, except for the leavings, which you could have at the sheriff houses, if you could stomach them. All very bad. But since Sharkey came, it's been plain ruination.
"Who is this Sharkey?" said Mary. "I heard one of the ruffians speak of him."
"The biggest ruffian of the lot, seemingly," answered Cotton. "It was about last harvest, end of September, maybe, that we first heard of him. We'd never seen him, but he's up at Bag End, and he's the real chief now, I guess. All the ruffians do what he says, and what he says is mostly hack, burn, and ruin. And now it's come to killing. There's no longer even any bad sense in it. They cut down trees and let 'em lie. They burn houses and build no more. Take Sandyman's Mill now. Pimple knocked it down almost as soon as he came to Bag End. Then he brought in a lot of dirty-looking men to build a bigger one and fill it full of wheels and outlandish contraptions. Only that fool Ted was pleased by that. And he works there cleaning wheels for the men, where his dad was the miller and his own master. Pimple's idea was to grind more and faster, or so he said. He's got other mills like it. But you've got to have grist before you can grind, and there was no more for the new mill to do than for the old. But since Sharkey came, they don't grind no more corn at all. They're always a-hammering and a-letting out a smoke and a stench, and there isn't no peace, even at night in Hobbiton. And they pour out filth o' purpose. They've fouled all the lower water, and it's getting down into Brandywine. If they want to make the shire into a desert, they're going the right way about it. I don't believe that fool of a Pimple's behind all this. It's Sharkey, I say."
"That's right," put in young Tom. "Why, they even took Pimple's old ma, that Lobelia, and he was fond of her, if no one else was. Some of the Hobbiton folk, they saw it. She comes down the lane with her old umbrella. Some of the ruffians were going up with a big cart. 'Where be you a-going?' says she. 'To Bag End,' says they. 'What for?' says she. 'To put up some sheds for Sharkey,' says they. 'Who said you could?' says she. 'Sharkey,' says they. 'So get out of the road, old haggling. I'll give you Sharkey, you dirty thieving ruffians,' says she, and ups with her umbrella and goes for the leader, near twice her size. So they took her, dragged her off to the lockholes, at her age too. They've taken others we miss more, but there's no denying she showed more spirit than most." Into the middle of this talk came Sam, bursting in with his gaffer. Old Gamgee didn't look much older, but he was a little deafer.
"Good evening, Mr. Baggins," he said. "Glad indeed I am to see you safe back. But I've a bone to pick with you, in a manner of speaking, if I may make so bold. You didn't never ought to have a soul Bag End, as I always said. That's what started all the mischief. And while you've been traipsing in foreign parts, chasing black men up mountains from what my Sam says, though what for he don't make clear, They've been and dug a bagshot row and ruined my taters.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Gamgee, said Frodo, but now I've come back, I'll do my best to make amends.
Well, you can't say fairer than that, said the gaffer. Mr. Frodo Baggins is a real gentle hobbit, I always have said, whatever you may think of some others of the name, begging your pardon. And I hope my Sam's behaved hisself and given satisfaction.
Perfect satisfaction, Mr. Gamgee, said Frodo.
Indeed, if you will believe it, he's now one of the most famous people in all the lands, and they're making songs about his deeds from here to the sea and beyond the great river.
Sam blushed, but he looked gratefully at Frodo, for Rose's eyes were shining and she was smiling at him.
It takes a lot of believing, said the gaffer, though I can see he's been mixing in strange company. What's come of his waistcoat? I don't hold with wearing ironmongery, whether it wears well or no.
Farmer Cotton's household and all his guests were up early next morning. Nothing had been heard in the night, but more trouble would certainly come before the day was old.
"Seems as if none of the ruffians were left up at Bag End," said Cotton, "but the gang from Weymeat will be along any time now."
After breakfast a messenger from the Tookland rode in. He was in high spirits.
"The Thane has raised all our country," he said, "and the news is going like fire always. The ruffians that were watching our land have fled off south, those that escaped alive. The Thane has gone after them to hold off the big gang down that way, but he sent Mr. Peregrine back with all the other folk he can spare."
The next news was less good. Meddy, who had been out all night, came riding in about 10 o'clock. "There's a big band about 4 miles away," he said. "They're coming along the road from Weymeat, but a good many stray ruffians have joined up with them. There must be close on 100 of them, and they're fire-raising as they come, curse them."
"Ah, this lot won't stay to talk. They'll kill if they can," said Farmer Cotton. "If Tooks don't come sooner, we'd best get behind cover and shoot without arguing. There's got to be some fighting before this is settled, Mr. Frodo."
The Tooks did come sooner. Before long they marched in, 100 strong, from Tuckborough and the Green Hills with Pippin at their head. Merry now had enough sturdy hobbitry to deal with the ruffians. Scouts reported that they were keeping close together. They knew that the countryside had risen against them, and plainly meant to deal with the rebellion ruthlessly at its centre in Bywater. But however grim they might be, they seemed to have no leader among them who understood warfare. They came on without any precautions. Merry laid his plans quickly. The ruffians came tramping along the east road, and without halting turned up the Bywater road, which ran for some way sloping up between high banks and low hedges on top. Round a bend, about a furlong from the main road, they met a stout barrier of old farm carts upturned. They halted them. At the same moment they became aware that the hedges on both sides, just above their heads, were all lined with hobbits. Behind them other hobbits now pushed out some more wagons that had been hidden in a field, and so blocked the way back. A voice spoke to them from above.
"Well, you have walked into a trap," said Merry. "Your fellows from Hobbiton did the same, and one is dead and the rest are prisoners. Lay down your weapons, then go back 20 paces and sit down. Any who try to break out will be shot."
But the ruffians could not now be cowed so easily. A few of them obeyed, but were immediately set on by their fellows. A score or more broke back and charged the wagons. 6 were shot, but the remainder burst out, killing 2 hobbits, and then scattering across country in the direction of the woody end. 2 more fell as they ran. Merry blew a loud horn call, and there were answering calls from a distance.
"They won't get far," said Pippin. "All that country is alive with our hunters now."
Behind, the trapped men in the lane, still about 40, tried to climb the barrier and the banks, and the hobbits were obliged to shoot many of them or hew them with axes. But many of the strongest and most desperate got out on the west side and attacked their enemies fiercely,
being now more bent on killing than escaping. Several hobbits fell, and the rest were wavering when Merry and Pippin, who were on the east side, came across and charged the ruffians. Merry himself slew the leader, a great squint-eyed brute like a huge orc. Then he drew his forces off, encircling the last remnant of the men in a wide ring of archers. At last all was over. Nearly 70 of the ruffians lay dead on the field, and a dozen were prisoners. 19 hobbits were killed, and some 30 were wounded. The dead ruffians were laden on wagons and hauled off to an old sandpit nearby and buried. In the battle pit, as it was afterwards called. The fallen hobbits were laid together in a grave on the hillside, where later a great stone was set up with a garden about it. So ended the Battle of Bywater, 1419, the last battle fought in the Shire, and the only battle since the Greenfields, 1147, away up in the North Farthing. In consequence, though it happily cost very few lives, it has a chapter to itself in the Red Book, and the names of all those who took part were made into a roll and learned by heart by Shire historians. The very considerable rise in the fame and fortune of the Cottons dates from this time, but at the top of the roll, in all accounts, stand the names of Captains Merry Ardoch and Peregrine. Frodo had been in the battle, but he had not drawn sword, and his chief part had been to prevent the hobbits in their wrath at their losses from slaying those of their enemies who threw down their weapons. When the fighting was over, and the later labours were ordered, Merry, Pippin and Sam joined him, and they rode back with the Cottons. They ate a late midday meal, and then Frodo said with a sigh, "Well, I suppose it's time now that we dealt with the chief." "Yes, indeed. The sooner the better," said Merry. "And don't be too gentle. He's responsible for bringing in these ruffians, and for all the evil they've done." Farmer Cotton collected an escort of some 24 sturdy hobbits.
"For it's only a guess that there is no ruffians left at Bag End," he said. "We don't know."
Then they set out on foot. Frodo, Sam, Merry and Pippin led the way. It was one of the saddest hours in their lives. The great chimney rose up before them, and as they drew near the old village across the water, through rows of new mean houses along each side of the road, they saw the new mill in all its frowning and dirty ugliness, a great brick building straddling the stream which it fouled with a steaming and stinking overflow. All along the bywater road every tree had been felled. As they crossed the bridge and looked up the hill, they gasped. Even Sam's vision in the mirror had not prepared him for what they saw. The old grange on the west side had been knocked down, and its place taken by rows of tarred sheds. All the chestnuts were gone. The banks and hedgerows were broken. Great wagons were standing in disorder in a field, beaten bare of grass. Bagshot Row was a yawning sand and gravel quarry. Bag End, up beyond, could not be seen for a clutter of large huts.
"They've cut it down," cried Sam. "They've cut down the party tree."
He pointed to where the tree had stood, under which Bilbo had made his farewell speech. It was lying lopped and dead in the field. As if this was the last straw, Sam burst into tears. A laugh put an end to them. There was a surly hobbit lounging over the low wall of the mill-yard. He was grimy-faced and black-handed.
"Don't he like it, Sam?" he sneered. "But you always was soft. I thought you'd gone off in one of them ships you used to prattle about. Sailing, sailing. What do you want to come back for? We've work to do in the Shire now."
"So I see," said Sam.
"No time for washing, but time for wall-propping.
But see here, Master Sandeman, I've a score to pay in this village, and don't you make it any longer with your jeering, or you'll foot a bill too big for your purse."
Ted Sandeman spat over the wall.
"Garn," he said, "you can't touch me. I'm a friend of the boss's, but he'll touch you all right if I have any more of your mouth."
"Don't waste any more words on the fool, Sam,"
said Frodo. "I hope there are not many more hobbits that have become like this. It would be a worse trouble than all the damage the men have done."
"You're dirty and insolent, Sandeman," said Merry, "and also very much out of your reckoning. We're just going up the hill to remove your precious boss. We've dealt with his men."
Ted gaped, for at that moment he first caught sight of the escort that, at a sign from Merry, now marched over the bridge. Dashing back into the mill, he ran out with a horn and blew it loudly.
"Save your breath," laughed Merry. "I've a better."
Then, lifting up his silver horn, he winded it, and its clear call rang over the hill, and out of the holes and sheds and shabby houses of Hobbiton, the hobbits answered, and came pouring out, and with cheers and loud cries they followed the company up the road to Bag End. At the top of the lane the party halted, and Frodo and his friends went on, and they came at last to the once-beloved place. The garden was full of huts and sheds, some so near the old westward windows that they cut off all their light. There were piles of refuse everywhere. The door was scarred, the bell chain was dangling loose, and the bell would not ring. Knocking brought no answer. At length they pushed, and the door yielded. They went in. The place stank and was full of filth and disorder. It did not appear to have been used for some time.
"Where's that miserable Lotho hiding?" said Merry.
They'd searched every room and found no living thing save rats and mice.
"Shall we turn on the others to search the sheds?"
"This is worse than Mordor," said Sam. "Much worse, in a way. It comes home to you, as they say, because it is home, and you remember it before it was all ruined."
"Yes, this is Mordor," said Frodo. "Just one of its works. Saruman was doing its work all the time, even when he thought he was working for himself. And the same with those that Saruman tricked, like Lotho." Merry looked round in dismay and disgust.
"Let's get out," he said. "If I'd known all the mischief he'd caused, I should have stuffed my pouch down Saruman's throat."
No doubt. But you didn't, and so I'm able to welcome you home."
There, standing at the door, was Saruman himself, looking well fed and well pleased. His eyes gleamed with malice and amusement. A sudden light broke on Frodo.
"Sharky!" he cried.
Saruman laughed.
"So you've heard the name, have you? All my people used to call me that in Isengard, I believe. A sign of affection, possibly. But evidently you didn't expect to see me here."
"I did not," said Frodo, "but I might have guessed. A little mischief in a mean way."
"Gandalf warned me that you are still capable of it."
"Quite capable," said Saruman. "And more than a little. You made me laugh, you hobbit lordlings, riding along with all those great people, so secure and so pleased with your little selves. You thought you'd done very well out of it all, and could now just amble back and have a nice quiet time in the country. Saruman's home could be all wrecked, and he could be turned out, but no one could touch yours. Oh, no! Gandalf would look after your affairs."
Saruman laughed again.
"Not he! When his tools have done their task, he drops them. But you must go dangling after them, dawdling and talking, and riding round twice as far as you needed." "Well," thought I, "if they're such fools, I'll get ahead of them and teach them a lesson. One ill turn deserves another." It would have been a sharper lesson, if only you'd given me a little more time and more men. Still, I've already done much that you'll find it hard to mend or undo in your lives, and it will be pleasant to think of that and set it against my injuries."
"Well, if that's what you find pleasure in," said Frodo, "I pity you. It will be a pleasure of my memory only, I fear. Go at once and never return." The hobbits of the villagers had seen Saruman come out of one of the huts, and at once they came crowding up to the door of Bag End. When they heard Frodo's command, they murmured angrily, "Don't let him go! Kill him! He's a villain and a murderer! Kill him!"
Saruman looked round at their hostile faces and smiled.
"Kill him," he mocked. "Kill him, if you think there are enough of you, my brave hobbits."
He drew himself up and stared at them darkly with his black eyes.
"But do not think that when I lost all my goods, I lost all my power. Whoever strikes me shall be accursed, and if my blood steams the Shire, it shall wither and never again be healed."
The hobbits recoiled, but Frodo said, "Don't believe him. He's lost all his power, save his voice that can still daunt you and deceive you if you let him. But I will not have him slain. It is useless to meet revenge with revenge. It will heal nothing. Go, Saruman, by the speediest way."
"Worm! Worm!"
Saruman called, and out of a nearby hut came Wormtongue, crawling almost like a dog.
"To the road again, Worm!" said Saruman. "These fine fellows and lordlings are turning us adrift again. Come along."
Saruman turned to go, and Wormtongue shuffled after him. But even as Saruman passed close to Frodo, a knife flashed in his hand, and he stabbed swiftly. The blade turned on the hidden mail coat and snapped. A dozen hobbits, led by Sam, leapt forward with a cry and flung the villain to the ground. Sam drew his sword.
"No, Sam," said Frodo. "Don't kill him even now, for he's not hurt me. And in any case, I don't wish him to be slain in this evil mood. He was great once, of a noble kind that we should not dare to raise our hands against. He is fallen, and his cure is beyond us. But I would still spare him, in the hope that he may find it."
Saruman rose to his feet and stared at Frodo. There was a strange look in his eyes, a mingled wonder and respect and hatred.
"You have grown, halfling," he said.
"Yes, you've grown very much.
You're wise and cruel. You have robbed my revenge of sweetness, and now I must go hence in bitterness, in debt to your mercy. I hate it and you. Well, I go and I will trouble you no more. But do not expect me to wish you health and long life. You will have neither. But that is not my doing. I merely foretell."
He walked away, and the hobbits made a lane for him to pass, but their knuckles whitened as they gripped on their weapons. Wormtongue hesitated, and then followed his master.
"Wormtongue," called Frodo, "you need not follow him. I know of no evil you have done to me. You can have rest and food here for a while, until you are stronger and can go your own ways."
Wormtongue halted and looked back at him, half prepared to stay. Saruman turned.
"No evil," he cackled. "Oh, no. Even when he sneaks out at night, it is only to look at the stars. But did I hear someone ask where poor Lotho is hiding? You know, don't you, Worm? Will you tell them?"
Wormtongue cowered down and whimpered.
"No, no."
"Then I will," said Saruman. "Worm killed your chief, poor little fellow, your nice little boss. Didn't you, Worm? Stabbed him in his sleep, I believe. Buried him, I hope. The Worm has been very hungry lately. No, Worm is not really nice. You'd better leave him to me."
A look of wild hatred came into Wormtongue's red eyes.
"You told me to. You made me do it," he hissed.
Saruman laughed.
"You do what Sharky says always, don't you, Worm? Well, now he says, follow."
He kicked Wormtongue in the face as he grovelled, and turned and made off. But at that something snapped. Suddenly Wormtongue rose up, drawing a hidden knife, and then with a snarl like a dog he sprang on Saruman's back, jerked his head back, cut his throat, and with a yell ran off down the lane. Before Frodo could recover or speak a word, three hobbit bows twanged, and Wormtongue fell dead. To the dismay of those that stood by, about the body of Saruman a grey mist gathered, and rising slowly to a great height like smoke from a fire, as a pale shrouded figure it loomed over the hill. For a moment it wavered, looking to the west,
but out of the west came a cold wind, and it bent away, and with a sigh dissolved into nothing. Frodo looked down at the body with pity and horror, for as he looked, it seemed that long years of death were suddenly revealed in it, and it shrank, and the shriveled face became rags of skin upon a hideous skull. Lifting up the skirt of the dirty cloak that sprawled beside it, he covered it over and turned away.
"And that's the end of that," said Sam.
"A nasty end, and I wish I needn't have seen it, but it's a good riddance." "And the very last end of the war, I hope," said Merry.
"I hope so," said Frodo and sighed. "The very last stroke. But to think that it should fall here, at the very door of Bag End. Among all my hopes and fears, at least I never expected that."
"I shan't call it the end till we've cleared up the mess," said Sam gloomily, "and that'll take a lot of time and work."
Chapter 9. The Grey Havens. The clearing up certainly needed a lot of work, but it took less time than Sam had feared. The day after the battle, Frodo rode to Mickle Delving and released the prisoners from the lockholes. One of the first that they found was poor Fredegar Bulger, fatty no longer. He'd been taken when the ruffians smoked out a band of rebels that he led from their hidings up in the Brockenbors by the hills of Skerry.
"You'd have done better to come with us after all, poor old Fredegar," said Pippin, as they carried him out, too weak to walk.
He opened an eye and tried gallantly to smile.
"Who's this young giant with a loud voice?" he whispered. "Not little Pippin. What's your size in hats now?"
Then there was Lobelia. Poor thing, she looked very old and thin when they rescued her from a dark and narrow cell. She insisted on hobbling out on her own feet, and she had such a welcome, and there was such clapping and cheering when she appeared, leaning on Frodo's arm but still clutching her umbrella, that she was quite touched, and drove away in tears. She'd never in her life been popular before, but she was crushed by the news of Lotho's murder, and she would not return to Bag End. She gave it back to Frodo, and went to her own people, the Brace Girdles of Hardbottle. When the poor creature died next spring, she was after all more than 100 years old, Frodo was surprised and much moved. She had left all that remained of her money and of Lotho's for him to use in helping hobbits made homeless by the Troubles. So that feud was ended. Old Will Whitfoot had been in the lockholds longer than any, and though he'd perhaps been treated less harshly than some, he needed a lot of feeding up before he could look the part of mayor. So Frodo agreed to act as his deputy, until Mr. Whitfoot was in shape again. The only thing that he did as deputy mayor was to reduce the sheriffs to their proper functions and numbers. The task of hunting out the last remnant of the ruffians was left to Merry and Pippin, and it was soon done. The southern gangs, after hearing the news of the Battle of Bywater, fled out of the land and offered little resistance to the Thane. Before the year's end, the few survivors were rounded up in the woods, and those that surrendered were shown to the borders. Meanwhile, the labour of repair went on apace, and Sam was kept very busy. Hobbits can work like bees when the mood and the need comes on them. Now there were thousands of willing hands of all ages, from the small but nimble ones of the hobbit lads and lasses to the well-worn and horny ones of the gaffers and gammers. Before Yule, not a brick was left standing of the new sheriff houses or of anything that had been built by Sharkey's men. But the bricks were used to repair many an old hole to make it snugger and drier. Great stores of goods and food and beer were found that had been hidden away by the ruffians in sheds and barns and deserted holes, and especially in the tunnels at Mickle Delving and in the old quarries at Skerry, so that there was a great deal better cheer that Yule than anyone had hoped for. One of the first things done in Hobbiton, before even the removal of the new mill, was the clearing of the hill and Bag End, and the restoration of Bagshot Row. The front of the new sandpit was all levelled and made into a large sheltered garden, and new holes were dug in the southward face,
back into the hill, and they were lined with brick. The gaffer was restored to number three, and he said often, and did not care who heard it,
"It's an ill wind as blows nobody no good, as I always say, and all's well as ends better."
There was some discussion of the name that the new row should be given. Battle Gardens was thought of, or Better Smiles. But after a while, in sensible hobbit fashion, it was just called New Row. It was a purely Bywater joke to refer to it as Sharky's End. The trees were the worst loss and damage, for at Sharky's bidding they'd been cut down recklessly far and wide over the shire, and Sam grieved over this more than anything else. For one thing, this hurt would take long to heal, and only his great-grandchildren, he thought, would see the shire as it ought to be. Then suddenly one day, for he had been too busy for weeks to give a thought to his adventures, he remembered the gift of Galadriel. He brought the box out and showed it to the other travellers, for so they were now called by everyone, and asked their advice. "I wondered when you'd think of it," said Frodo. "Open it." Inside it was filled with a grey dust, soft and fine, in the middle of which was a seed, like a small nut with a silver shale.
"What can I do with this?" said Sam.
"Throw it in the air on a breezy day and let it do its work," said Pippin.
"On what?"
said Sam.
"Choose one spot as a nursery and see what happens to the plants there," said Merry.
"But I'm sure the lady would not like me to keep it all for my own garden, now so many folk have suffered," said Sam.
"Use all the wits and knowledge you have of your own, Sam," said Frodo, "and then use the gift to help your work and better it, and use it sparingly. There's not much here, and I expect every grain has a value."
So Sam planted saplings in all the places where specially beautiful or beloved trees had been destroyed, and he put a grain of the precious dust in the soil at the root of each. He went up and down the shire in this labour, but if he paid special attention to Hobbiton and Bywater, no one blamed him. And at the end he found that he still had a little of the dust left, so he went to the three-farthing stone, which is as near the centre of the shire as no matter, and cast it in the air with his blessing. The little silver nut he planted in the party field where the tree had once been, and he wondered what would come of it. All through the winter he remained as patient as he could, and tried to restrain himself from going round constantly to see if anything was happening. Spring surpassed his wildest hopes. His trees began to sprout and grow as if time was in a hurry and wished to make 1 year do for 20. In the party field a beautiful young sapling leapt up. It had silver bark and long leaves and burst into golden flowers in April. It was, indeed, a Mallorn, and it was the wonder of the neighbourhood. In after years, as it grew in grace and beauty, it was known far and wide, and people would come long journeys to see it, the only Mallorn west of the mountains and east of the sea, and one of the finest in the world. Altogether 1420 in the shire was a marvellous year. Not only was there wonderful sunshine and delicious rain, in due times and perfect measure, but there seemed something more, an air of richness and growth, and a gleam of beauty beyond that of mortal summers that flicker and pass upon this middle earth. All the children born or begotten in that year, and there were many, were fair to see and strong, and most of them had a rich golden hair that had before been rare among hobbits. The fruit was so plentiful that young hobbits very nearly bathed in strawberries and cream, and later they sat on the lawns under the plum trees and ate until they had made piles of stones like small pyramids or the heaped skulls of a conqueror, and then they moved on. And no one was ill, and everyone was pleased, except those who had to mow the grass. In the south farthing the vines were laden, and the yield of leaf was astonishing, and everywhere there was so much corn that at harvest every barn was stuffed. The north farthing barley was so fine that the beer of 1420 malt was long remembered and became a byword.
Indeed, a generation later, one might hear an old gaffer in an inn, after a good pint of well-earned ale, put down his mug with a sigh.
"Ah, that was proper 1420, that was."
Sam stayed at first at the Cottons with Frodo, but when the new row was ready, he went with the gaffer. In addition to all his other labours, he was busy directing the cleaning up and restoring a Bag End, but he was often away in the Shire on his forestry work. So he was not at home in early March, and did not know that Frodo had been ill. On the 13th of that month, Farmer Cotton found Frodo lying on his bed. He was clutching a white gem that hung on a chain about his neck, and he seemed half in a dream. "It is gone forever," he said, "and now all is dark and empty." But the fit passed, and when Sam got back on the 25th, Frodo had recovered, and he said nothing about himself. In the meanwhile, Bag End had been set in order, and Merry and Pippin came over from Crick Hollow, bringing back all the old furniture and gear, so that the old hole soon looked very much as it always had done. When all was at last ready, Frodo said, "When are you going to move in and join me, Sam?" Sam looked a bit awkward. "There's no need to come yet, if you don't want to," said Frodo. "But you know the gaffer's close at hand, and he'll be very well looked after by Widow Rumble." "It's not that, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, and he went very red. "Well, what is it?"
"It's Rosie, Rose Cotton," said Sam. "It seems she didn't like my going abroad at all, poor lass. But as I hadn't spoken, she couldn't say so, and I didn't speak because I had a job to do first. But now I've spoken, and she says, 'Well, you've wasted a year, so why wait longer?'"
"Wasted?" I says.
"I wouldn't call it that. Still, I see what she means. I feel torn in two, as you might say."
"I see," said Frodo.
"You want to get married, and yet you want to live with me in Bag End too. But, my dear Sam, how easy? Get married as soon as you can, and then move in with Rosie. There's room enough in Bag End for as big a family as you could wish for."
And so it was settled. Sam Gamgee married Rose Cotton in the spring of 1420, which was also famous for its weddings, and they came and lived at Bag End. And if Sam thought himself lucky, Frodo knew that he was more lucky himself, for there was not a hobbit in the Shire that was looked after with such care. When the labours of repair had all been planned and set going, he took to a quiet life, writing a great deal and going through all his notes. He resigned the office of deputy mayor at the Free Fair that midsummer, and dear old Will Whitfoot had another 7 years of presiding at banquets. Merry and Pippin lived together for some time at Crick Hollow, and there was much coming and going between Buckland and Bag End. The two young travellers cut a great dash in the Shire, with their songs and their tales and their finery and their wonderful parties. "Lordly," folk called them, meaning nothing but good, for it warmed all hearts to see them go riding by with their mail shirts so bright and their shields so splendid, laughing and singing songs afar away. And if they were now large and magnificent, they were unchanged otherwise, unless they were indeed more fair-spoken and more jovial and full of merriment than ever before. Frodo and Sam, however, went back to ordinary attire, except that when there was need they both wore long grey cloaks, finely woven and clasped at the throat with beautiful brooches, and Mr. Frodo wore always a white jewel on a chain that he often would finger. All things now went well, with hope always of becoming still better, and Sam was as busy and as full of delight as even a hobbit could wish. Nothing for him marred the whole year, except for some vague anxiety about his master. Frodo dropped quietly out of all the doings of the Shire, and Sam was pained to notice how little honour he had in his own country. Few people knew or wanted to know about his deeds and adventures. Their admission and respect were given mostly to Mr. Meriardoc, Peregrine, and if Sam had known it,
to himself. Also in the autumn there appeared a shadow of old troubles. One evening Sam came into the study and found his master looking very strange. He was very ill. His eyes seemed to see far away. "What's the matter, Mr. Frodo? Said Sam. "I'm wounded," he answered. "Wounded. It will never really heal." And he was then he but got up himself the next the turn seemed to pass, and he was quite himself the next day. It was not until afterwards that Sam recalled that the date was October 6th. 2 years before, on that day, it was in the Dale Weathertop. Time on. 1421 came in. Frodo was ill again in Notch, but with a great effort he concealed it, for first of Sam and Rosie's children was born on the 25th of March, a date that Sam noted.
"Well, Mr. Frodo," he said, "I bit of a fix. Rose and me had settled to call him Frodo, with your leave, but it's not him, it's her. Though as pretty a maid child as anyone could hope for, taking after Rose more than me, luckily. So we don't know what to do."
"Well, Sam," said Frodo, "what's wrong with the old customs? Choose a flower name like Rose. Half the maid children in the Shire are called by such names, and what could be better?"
"I suppose you're right, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "I've heard some beautiful names on my travels, but I suppose they're a bit too grand for daily wear and tear, as you might say. The gaffer, he says, 'Make it short, and then you won't have to cut it short before you can use it.'
But if it's to be a flower name, then I don't trouble about the length. It must be a beautiful flower, because, you see, I think she's very beautiful, and is going to be beautifuller still." Frodo thought for a moment. "Well, Sam, what about Eleanor, the Sun Star? You remember the little golden flower in the grass of Lothlorien?"
"You're right again, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, delighted. "That's what I wanted."
Little Eleanor was nearly 6 months old, and 1421 had passed to its autumn when Frodo called Sam into the study. "It'll be Bilbo's birthday on Thursday, Sam," he said, "and he'll pass the old Took. He'll be 131.
"So he will," said Sam. "He's a marvel."
"Well, Sam," said Frodo, "I want you to see Rose and find out if she can spare you, so that you and I can go off together. You can't go far, or for a long time now, of course," he said a little wistfully.
"Well, not very well, Mr. Frodo."
"Of course not. But never mind. You can see me on my way. Tell Rose that you won't be away very long, not more than a fortnight, and you'll come back quite safe."
"I wish I could go all the way with you to Rivendell, Mr. Frodo, and see Mr. Bilbo," said Sam. "And yet the only place I really want to be in is here. I am that torn in two."
"Poor Sam.
It will feel like that, I'm afraid," said Frodo. "But you'll be healed. You were meant to be solid and whole, and you will be."
In the next day or two, Frodo went through his papers and his writings with Sam, and he handed over his keys. There was a big book with plain red leather covers. Its tall pages were now almost filled. At the beginning, there were many leaves covered with Bilbo's thin, wandering hand, but most of it was written in Frodo's firm, flowing script. It was divided into chapters, but chapter 80 was unfinished, and after that were some blank leaves. The title page had many titles on it, crossed out one after another, so: "My Diary," "My Unexpected Journey," "There and Back Again," and "What Happened After," "Adventures of Five Hobbits," "The Tale of the Great Ring, compiled by Bilbo Baggins from his own observations and the accounts of his friends," "What We Did in the War of the Ring." Here Bilbo's hand ended, and Frodo had written: "The Downfall of the Lord of the Rings and the Return of the King."
as seen by the little people, being the memoirs of Bilbo and Frodo of the Shire, supplemented by the accounts of their friends and the learning of the wise, together with extracts from books of lore translated by Bilbo in Rivendell.
"Why, you've nearly finished it, Mr. Frodo," Sam exclaimed. "Well, you have kept at it, I must say."
"I have quite finished, Sam," said Frodo. "The last pages are for you." On September the 21st they set out together, Frodo on the pony that had borne him all the way from Minas Tirith and was now called Strider, and Sam on his beloved Bill. It was a fair golden morning, and Sam did not ask where they were going. He thought he could guess. They took the stock road over the hills and went towards the woody end, and they let their ponies walk at their leisure. They camped in the green hills, and on September the 22nd they rode gently down into the beginning of the trees as afternoon was wearing away.
"If that isn't the very tree you hid behind when the Black Rider first showed up, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, pointing to the left. "It seems like a dream now."
It was evening, and the stars were glimmering in the eastern sky as they passed the ruined oak, and turned and went on down the hill between the hazel thickets. Sam was silent, deep in his memories. Presently he became aware that Frodo was singing softly to himself, singing the old walking song, but the words were not quite the same.
"Still round the corner there may wait a new road or a secret gate, and though I oft have passed them by, a day will come at last when I shall take the hidden paths that run west of the moon, east of the sun."
And, as if in answer, from down below, coming up the road out of the valley, voices sang,
"O el bereth gilthod I el, silivren penna miriel, o menel agla elenoth. Gilthod I el, a el bereth, we still remember we who dwell in this far land beneath the trees, the starlight on the western seas."
Frodo and Sam halted and sat silent in the soft shadows until they saw a shimmer as the travellers came towards them. There was Gildor and many fair elven folk, and there, to Sam's wonder, rode Elrond and Galadriel. Elrond wore a mantle of grey, and had a star upon his forehead, and a silver was hand in his hand, and upon his finger was a ring of gold, with a great blue stone, Velia, mightiest of the three. But Galadriel sat upon white palfrey, and was robed all in glimmering white, like clouds about the moon, for she herself seemed to shine with a soft light. On her finger was Nenya, the ring wrought of mithril, that bore a single white stone flickering like a frosty star. Riding slowly behind on a small grey pony, and seeming to nod in his sleep, was Bilbo himself. Elrond greeted them gravely and graciously, and Galadriel smiled upon them.
"Well, Master Samwise," she said, "I hear and see that you have used my gift well. The Shire shall now be more than ever blessed and beloved." Sam bowed, but found nothing to say. He had forgotten how beautiful the lady was. Then Bilbo woke up and opened his eyes.
"Hello, Frodo," he said.
"Well, I've passed the old Took today, so that's settled. And now I think I'm quite ready to go on another journey. Are you coming?"
"Yes, I'm coming," said Frodo. "The ring bearers should go together."
"Where are you going, master?"
cried Sam, though at last he understood what was happening.
"To the Havens, Sam," said Frodo.
"And I can't come?"
"No, Sam,
Not yet, anyway. Not further than the Havens. Though you too were a ring-bearer, if only for a little while. Your time may come. Don't be too sad, Sam. You can't be always torn in two. You'll have to be one and whole for many years. You've so much to enjoy and to be and to do.
But,
said Sam, and tears started in his eyes,
I thought you were going to enjoy the Shire, too, for years and years after all you've done.
So I thought, too, once. But I've been too deeply hurt, Sam. I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved. But not for me. It must often be so, Sam, when things are in danger. Someone has to give them up, lose them, so that others may keep them. But you're my heir. All that I had and might have had I leave to you.
And also you have Rose and Eleanor, and Frodo lad will come, and Rosie lass, and Merry, and Goldilocks, and Pippin, and perhaps more that I cannot see. Your hands and your wits will be needed everywhere. You will be the mayor, of course, as long as you want to be, and the most famous gardener in history, and you will read things out of the Red Book, and keep alive the memory of the age that is gone, so that people will remember the great danger, and so love their beloved land all the more. And that will keep you as busy and as happy as anyone can be, as long as your part of the story goes on. Come now, ride with me. Then Elrond and Galadriel rode on, for the Third Age was over, and the days of the rings were past, and an end was come of the story and song of those times. With them went many elves of the high kindred who would no longer stay in Middle-earth, and among them, filled with a sadness that was yet blessed and without bitterness, rode Sam and Frodo and Bilbo, and the elves delighted to honour them. Though they rode through the midst of the Shire all the evening and all the night, none saw them pass, save the wild creatures, or here and there some wanderer in the dark, who saw a swift shimmer under the trees, or a light and shadow flowing through the grass as the moon went westward. And when they had passed from the Shire, going about the south skirts of the White Downs, they came to the Far Downs, and to the Towers, and looked on the distant sea. And so they rode down at last to Mithlond, to the grey havens and the long firth of Lune. As they came to the gates, Círdan the shipwright came forth to greet them. Very tall he was, and his beard was long, and he was grey and old, save that his eyes were keen as stars. And he looked at them and bowed and said,
All is now ready.
Then Círdan led them to the havens, and there was a white ship lying, and upon the quay, beside a great grey horse, stood a figure robed all in white awaiting them. As he turned and came towards them, Frodo saw that Gandalf now wore openly upon his hand the third ring, Narjar the Great, and the stone upon it was red as fire. Then those who were to go were glad, for they knew that Gandalf also would take ship with them. But Sam was now sorrowful at heart, and it seemed to him that if the parting would be bitter, more grievous still would be the long road home, alone. But even as they stood there, and the elves were going aboard, and all was being made ready to depart, up rode Merry and Pippin in great haste, and amid his tears Pippin laughed.
"You tried to give us the slip once before and failed, Frodo," he said. This time you've nearly succeeded, but you have failed again. It was not Sam, though, that gave you away this time, but Gandalf himself.
Yes, said Gandalf, for it will be better to ride back three together than one alone. Well, here at last, dear friends, on the shores of the sea, comes the end of our fellowship in Middle-earth. Go in peace. I will not say, do not weep, for not all tears are an evil.
Then Frodo kissed Merry and Pippin, and last of all Sam, and went aboard, and the sails were drawn up, and the wind blew, and slowly the ship slipped away down the long grey firth, and the light of the glass of Galadriel that Frodo bore glimmered and was lost. And the ship went out into the high sea, and passed on into the west, until at last, on a night of rain, Frodo smelled a sweet fragrance on the air, and heard the sound of singing that came over the water. And then it seemed to him that, as in his dream in the house of Bombadil, the grey rain curtain turned all to silver glass and was rolled back, and he beheld white shores and beyond them a far green country under a swift sunrise. But to Sam the evening deepened to darkness as he stood on the haven, and as he looked at the grey sea he saw only a shadow on the waters that was soon lost in the west. There still he stood far into the night, hearing only the sigh and murmur of the waves on the shores of Middle-earth, and the sound of them sank deep into his heart. Beside him stood Merry and Pippin, and they were silent. At last the three companions turned away, and never again looking back, they rode slowly homewards, and they spoke no word to one another until they came back to the Shire, but each had great comfort in his friends on the long grey road. At last they rode over the downs and took the east road, and then Merry and Pippin rode on to Buckland, and already they were singing again as they went. But Sam turned to Bywater, and so came back up the hill as day was ending once more. And he went on, and there was yellow light and fire within, and the evening meal was ready, and he was expected. And Rose drew him in, and set him in his chair, and put little Eleanor upon his lap. He drew a deep breath.
"Well, I'm back," he said.
The End. You've been listening to The Return of the King, the third and final book of The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, narrated in its entirety by Robert Inglis. In the authorized version of The Lord of the Rings, from which this recording has been made, the author prefaced the story with a long essay concerning hobbits, the Shire and its government, and the original Shire sources and records in which this story was first recorded. This essay is included on the following disc.